Chapter 41, Sandalwood Country. The jungle through which our road lay, and which we saw from the front seat of Krishna's coach, was not of the lush, green, tropical variety, but for the most part dry, brown, and dusty. Indeed, it was bush rather than true jungle. On either side of the deeply rutted track, so thick with white dust that we could be said to plough rather than drive our way through, medium-sized trees, many of them practically leafless, rising sparsely out of a tangle of undergrowth, stretched as far back as I could see. Sunshine and dust seemed to cover all. Every 20 or 30 miles came a halt, when there would be a general climbing in and out of passengers, besides much loading and unloading of baggage. And when Krishna would bring us little brass tumblers of tea and strange Mysorean delicacies wrapped in banana leaves. At night we stayed in the local government bungalow or with friends of Krishna's. As on previous occasions when the travelling arrangements were in somebody else's hands and I had no decisions to make, I relaxed in my seat and became simply the spectator of the scenes through which we passed. If these were monotonous or of no special interest, I withdrew into myself and became absorbed in my own inner experience. Thus, our 10 or 12 day trip was for me a kind of waking dream, a dream from which I emerged only at intervals, when something of particular significance claimed my attention, and I can give of it, therefore, no connected account. All that remains are isolated images, the exact sequence of which it is no longer possible to determine. But though the sequence of the images may have been forgotten, the images themselves are still fresh and vivid, emerging with archetypal brilliance from the nondescript jungle of my dreams. The temples of Belur and Halivid, built under the Hoysala dynasty in the 12th and 14th centuries, were quite different from those of Madura, Cape Comorin, Suchindram and Tiruvannamalai. Their forms are more compact and rounded. Here were no fortress-like walls, no spacious courtyards, no soaring gate towers. Everything was on a smaller and more intimate scale. If the shrines that dominated the flat, bare landscape of the Tamil countryside needed to be systematically explored, those that now rose to meet us out of the jungles of Mysore could be taken in at a single glance. If those were sublime, these were beautiful. There the gate towers and the capitals of pillars were splendidly sculpted indeed, but here everything was covered inside and outside with carving as bold as a bunch of fruit and as delicate as lace. On the outside walls, bands of sculpture extended from top to bottom, the horizontal courses making a pleasant contrast with the full, not to say bulbous, outlines of the buildings. Despite the appeal of the divine and semi-divine figures so gloriously sculptured in the panels of the middle and upper bands, my attention was drawn chiefly by the bottommost band, where a procession of diminutive elephants ran round the base of the entire temple, which seemed almost to float on their backs. Though there must have been hundreds of elephants, each one was different, and all were astonishingly alive. One of the temples seemed to have no windows. The only natural light came in at the door through which we had just entered. As we struggled to make out the dim shapes by which we were surrounded, the broad yellow beam of a spotlight suddenly stabbed upwards into the dome above our heads. As it crept slowly round, scene after richly sculptured scene was revealed to our gaze, the swarms of black stone figures standing out sharply in the glare. Eventually, having traversed the dome and picked its way carefully down the wall, the spotlight came to rest on a freestanding female figure of smoothly polished black basalt near the door. So languidly beautiful were the limbs, so voluptuously sweet the face, that none who had once beheld her could easily turn away. It was Mohini the Deluder, embodiment of all feminine witchery, in whose infinitely charming form the god Vishnu had tempted Shiva himself from his asceticism, and caused him to beget, for the salvation of the world, a hero to destroy demons and resuscitate Dharma. Having torn ourselves from the embrace of Mohini and said goodbye to the temples of Bela and Halivid, we passed through more jungle, some of it denser and greener than any we had just seen, through coffee plantations, through vast tracts of sandalwood forest, and through yet more jungle. Somewhere in the jungle there was a mountain, and somewhere on the side of the mountain was a cave. In the cave lived four or five people, the devotees of a female ascetic who lived not in the cave itself, but in an underground chamber beneath the floor of the cave, emerging for only half an hour each day. When Satyapriya and I arrived at the cave with Krishna, it was about noon, and Mother Lakshmi, as she was called, was expected to come out within the next 10 or 15 minutes. While we were waiting, we asked the devotees for further information about her. 8 years ago, she had taken a vow to observe complete silence for the next 12 years, which meant that only 4 more years now remained. What she would do after that, they did not know. Perhaps she would speak. Perhaps she would take another vow of silence. At present, most of her time was spent in meditation. The only reason she left her underground retreat even once a day was to answer the calls of nature and take a little food. From the way in which the devotees spoke, it was clear that, though they saw so little of her, they regarded it as a great privilege to be able to live in such close proximity to her and minister to her needs. While we were talking, Mother Lakshmi's grey head appeared through a hole in the floor, and with the gentle assistance of the devotees, she slowly emerged into the cave. After steadying herself on her feet, the frail, white-clad figure turned her head in the direction of Satyapriya and myself, and advanced towards us with hands outstretched in welcome, on her face a smile of tenderness and affection. Though nothing was said, her quiet, graceful gestures, as well as the way in which she gazed up into our faces and stroked our cheeks, were far more expressive than any words. When we had been given something to eat, she indicated, with more gestures, that we were to go, once at a time, down the hole and have a look at her underground chamber. After descending a short flight of rough stone steps, I found myself crouching in a cell not more than 4 feet square and of about the same height. Small as Mother Lakshmi was, it would have been impossible for her either to stand upright or to stretch out full length on the floor. There was no ventilation other than that provided by the stairway, while the sole illumination came from a tiny oil lamp placed on the floor. Apart from Mother Lakshmi's meditation mat and a tiny altar with 2 or 3 religious pictures, the chamber was completely bare. It was also completely silent, for all the sound that could be heard from the cave upstairs, the people there might have been 1,000,000 miles away. In that chamber one really was alone. I could not help wondering what it was that enabled Mother Lakshmi to sit there for more than 23 hours out of the 24, and gave such ethereal sweetness to her smile. 2 or 3 days later, I was speculating about the inner experiences, not of a comparatively unknown female ascetic, but about one of the most prominent figures in the Orthodox Hindu ecclesiastical establishment. Travelling through still more jungle, we had come to the little riverside town of Sringeri, which was situated only a few miles from the coast and marked the westernmost point of our whole excursion. Sringeri, as I well knew, was the seat of the Shankaracharya of that name. More than 1,000 years earlier, the original Shankaracharya, founder of the Advaita Vedanta school of Indian philosophy, had established in different parts of the subcontinent a series of maths, or monastic centres, for the dissemination of his own special interpretation of the Upanishadic tradition, as well as for the revival of Orthodox Hinduism. Four of these maths, including that of Puri, with one of whose Shankaracharyas at least we were already acquainted, had in course of time attained to a generally acknowledged ascendancy, and among these four, Sringeri was undoubtedly preeminent. If not the Vatican of Hinduism, as guidebooks sometimes claimed, it was by far the wealthiest of the maths, with a long tradition of Sanskrit learning, impeccable socio-religious orthodoxy, ecclesiastical dominance, and political influence. Since admission to the math was strictly limited to members of the two highest castes, there was, of course, no question of our being accommodated within its precincts. Indeed, it seemed doubtful if we would get so much of a glimpse of the place from the inside. The original Shankaracharya was even now venerated by the Orthodox as the destroyer of the hated Buddhists and the exterminator of their pernicious faith, and we could hardly expect much of a welcome at the seat of his principal successor. A surprise, however, was in store for us. Though we could not be accommodated in the math, thanks to Krishna's influence, room was found for us in the modern Western-style guest house, which it maintained for the benefit of high-ranking government officials, princes, millionaires, and others who, though their unclean presence could not be tolerated within the actual math area, were important enough for the math authorities to be anxious not to offend them by too unceremonious a reception. The guest house was situated on the roadside quite near the math. Looking across the river from the window of our second floor room, we could see among the flame of the forest trees on the opposite bank the whitewashed buildings of the forbidden city of the Shankaracharyas. Fortunately, it did not remain forbidden for long. Also staying at the guest house was a tall, portly Tamil Brahmin in the traditional white sarong and shoulder towel, who lost no time in introducing himself to us. He was staying there, apparently, on a semi-permanent basis, having been seconded to Sringeri as administrator of the math from the Ministry of Home Affairs in New Delhi. The math had vast landed properties in every part of India, he explained, properties that had been gifted by kings and merchant princes over a period of many centuries, and its annual income amounted to millions. Among other things, it owned practically all the sandalwood forests in Mysore. Unfortunately, in recent years, there had been repeated complaints about the administration of the math estates and the spending of its revenues, and the matter having become almost practically a public scandal, the central government had been forced to intervene, and he himself had been appointed administrator. For the last year or more, he had been engaged in cleaning out whatever was the Hindu mythological equivalent of an Orgian stable of inefficiency, mismanagement, and downright corruption. Now, however, something like order had been introduced into the chaos. Collection of revenues had been entrusted to reliable persons. A proper system of accounting had been established. And above all, expenditure had been brought under control, so that some at least of the math resources were now being utilised in accordance with the original intentions of the donors, instead of being used to provide dowries for Telugu Brahmin girls and pay for the Upanayanam ceremonies of Telugu Brahmin boys. Not understanding how the Telugu Brahmin boys and girls came into the picture in this way, and seeing that our new friend was inclined to be communicative, Satchapri and I asked for further information on the subject. The administrator at once obliged. Perhaps we did not know it, he said. But despite the fact that the original Shankaracharya was a Nambudiri Brahmin from Malabar, for some centuries past, the Shankaracharyas of Sringeri Math had been drawn exclusively from a particular subcaste of Telugu Brahmins living in the Andhra country on the east coast. As a result of this custom, the office of Shankaracharya had become in effect the private appanage of that community, the members of which considered themselves entitled to dip into the Math's treasury as frequently as they pleased. Whenever a daughter was married, the Math was called upon to provide the dowry. Whenever a son was invested with the sacred thread, the Math was called upon to meet the expenses of the ceremony. As every Brahmin family had at least 5 or 6 children, and as 1,000 rupees was the least that was expected on such occasions, there was thus a perpetual drain on the Math's resources. Indeed, dowries and Upanayanam ceremonies had swallowed up the greater part of the revenues every year, so that very little was left over for other purposes. Some of the Brahmin families, on one pretext or another, had lived entirely off the Math, doing no work at all of any kind. But now, he declared with evident satisfaction, the flow of money was beginning to dry up. The Math was no longer subsidizing an entire subcaste of Telugu Brahmins. Its revenues were being devoted to more worthy purposes. A Sanskrit college had been built. Vedic education was being encouraged. By this time, both Satchapriya and I were wondering what part the Shankaracharya himself played in the affairs of the Math. Was he the unwilling spectator of the corruption, or part of it? Did he support the administrator's reforms, or was he opposed to them? Above all, was he a spiritual personage in his own right, or just a particularly high-ranking Hindu ecclesiastical dignitary? At the mention of the Shankaracharya's name, for these thoughts were soon put into words, our informant's expression changed from virtuous triumph to rapt devotion. The Shankaracharya was a saint, he exclaimed. He knew absolutely nothing of what was going on around him. He was immersed in perpetual samadhi. Some members of his entourage had spread a report that he was mad, some of them even wanting to get rid of him. But he was not mad. He was perfectly sane. Or if he was mad, it was with the madness of God intoxication. He was a liberated soul, a Jivan Mukta. On no account should we leave Sringeri without having the blessing of his darshan. He himself would arrange an interview. It was not usual, of course. Only Brahmins and Kshatriyas were permitted to enter the Math, and only Brahmins of unblemished orthodoxy could come within speaking distance of the Shankaracharya, or actually converse with him. And though we had been strangely reticent on the subject, he knew perfectly well that one of us, at least, was a non-Brahmin, possibly something even less acceptable to the orthodox. But never mind, he asked no questions. For him it was quite enough that we were sadhus, ascetics, who had nothing to do with the caste system. If we would accompany him to the Math the following morning, he would not only show us the temples and other places of interest, but station us where we would have the opportunity of seeing the Shankaracharya on his way to his ceremonial ablutions, perhaps of exchanging a few words with him. He could assure us categorically that, much as his entourage might disapprove, the Shankaracharya himself had no objection whatever to speaking with anyone. The administrator's offer having anticipated our own wishes. Next morning, Satchapriya and I rejoiced to find ourselves crossing the ancient whitewashed bridge that was, apparently, the sole means of access to the Math from the guest house side of the river. On the way, our guide proved no less communicative than before, and not only told us more about the Math and its inmates, but also, consciously and unconsciously, revealed more of himself. with his combination of theological acumen and administrative vigour, of orthodox piety and worldly shrewdness. He evidently belonged to a class of Brahmins who in ancient times had advised kings and administered kingdoms, and of whom, in the present century, the notorious Diwan of Travancore, Sir C.P. Ramaswamy Iyer, was perhaps the most illustrious example. Like other men of business whom we had met, and whose protestations we had once believed, he professed to be thoroughly disgusted with the world, and to long only for the peace of the hermit, or the freedom of the wandering ascetic. "If only he could have had his own way," he exclaimed in a voice that might have been called a sigh if it had not been so loud. "He would have spent the first half of his life studying the Rig Veda, and the second half of his life meditating upon it. In this Veda, from one of the inspired authors of which he himself was descended, there were to be found all the truths that had ever been taught by all the philosophies and all religions of the world, and much more beside. Surprised as we might be to hear it," he added, "even the vaunted discoveries of modern science were not discoveries at all, but only borrowings from this priceless work, though for reasons best known to themselves, perhaps on account of feelings of national pride, Western scientists had so far not cared to acknowledge their indebtedness to the sages of ancient India." Before I had time to question this assertion, with which I knew Satchapriya was inclined to agree, we had entered the math premises, and our loquacious friend had changed the subject. With the temples and other buildings all about us, it was not surprising that he should start expatiating on the power and splendour of these Shankaracharyas of Sringeri Math. Whenever they went out, which was not often, they rode in golden palanquins on the backs of elephants, and were attended by a numerous retinue. On their arrival at the borders of such states as acknowledged their spiritual overlordship, of which only Travancore, Cochin, and Mysore now remained, the ruler of the state thus honoured was compelled by ancient custom to welcome them in person and make offerings amounting to millions of rupees, though if he was not of sufficiently high caste, he was not actually permitted to approach the Shankaracharya. From the relish with which he recounted these facts, it was clear that, despite his reformist zeal, our friend's imagination had been stirred by what the editor of the Children's Encyclopedia would have called the romance of the Shankaracharyas. But it was also clear that enthusiasm for the past had not been permitted to blind him to the realities of the present. Times had changed, he declared. Much of the old pomp had gone, and the present Shankaracharya did not care even for what little was left. Among other eccentricities, he steadfastly refused to wear his regalia, which was of solid gold, studded with enormous precious stones, and worth hundreds of millions of rupees. He even refused to wear it on ceremonial occasions, and on this account the members of his entourage were extremely displeased and dissatisfied with him. Indeed, they were displeased and dissatisfied with him on a number of accounts. So much so was this the case, in fact, that, besides spreading the story of his madness, they had recently compelled him, very much against his will, to consecrate as his successor a young man more after their own hearts. By the time we had learned all this and heard the history of the various temples round which our good-natured guide insisted on conducting us, the hour of the Shankaracharya's mid-morning bath had struck, and he was on his way to the river for the second ceremonial ablutions of the day. Stationing us on the steps of a small temple near the water, with instructions to wait there until the Shankaracharya passed by, the worthy administrator hastened away to join the little procession that escorted the Shankaracharya to the screened-off section of river, where, assisted by his personal attendants, he took his bath out of the sight of profane eyes. Though we did not have to wait many minutes, there was time for a number of thoughts to pass through our minds. Was the Shankaracharya a saint, as the administrator appeared to believe, or was he mentally unbalanced? Would we be able to speak to him, or would the members of his entourage object? As we were asking ourselves these questions, a slight saffron-clad figure came into view round the corner of a nearby building, and started moving slowly and unsteadily in the direction of the river. Behind him, no less slowly, came an untidy procession of attendants and math officials in white dhotis and sacred threads. Some of them, among whom was the administrator, walked quite close to the Shankaracharya, as if in readiness to catch him if he staggered or fell. Whatever its significance might be, whether spiritual or pathological, the frail, elderly man at the head of the procession was clearly in no ordinary state of mind. Scarcely conscious of his surroundings, he moved like a sleepwalker or a drugged person, or as though in a trance. When he was nearly abreast of us, Satyapriya and I, descending the temple steps, came forward and waited in the middle of the path. The administrator moved to the Shankaracharya's side and whispered a few words of explanation. The procession halted, and we stood face to face. After we had saluted the official head of the Advaita Vedanta tradition and received his blessing, he asked us one or two questions, and a brief conversation ensued. Though he was undoubtedly in a state of semi-abstraction from the world, and though he spoke with a hesitancy that was almost fearfulness, whatever he said was perfectly rational, while there was no mistaking the genuine kindliness and gentleness of his disposition. Somewhat to our surprise, he spoke in English, as of course we did too, the administrator helping out with a murmured translation whenever my accent was unintelligible to him. After we had bidden farewell to the Shankaracharya and seen his procession escort him as far as the bank of the river, we stayed behind for a few minutes to say goodbye to the administrator and thank him for all the trouble he had taken. As we did so, along came the Shankaracharya's successor designate, or the Junior Shankaracharya, as he was called, walking at the head of a little procession of his own, with what could only be described as a military swagger. About 25 years of age, handsome and well-built, it was clear that, when the time came, he would have no objection whatever to wearing the regalia. For some time after we had crossed the bridge and made our way back to the guest house, I could not help thinking of the frail, saffron-clad figure and vacant, kindly face of the unwanted Shankaracharya, and wondering what was the nature of his experience. He seemed like a man who was still recovering from some terrible shock. Was this shock the impact of undiluted spiritual reality, or was it something more mundane? Was he, perhaps, a sensitive person of genuine spirituality, who, not being strong enough to withstand the various pressures to which he was subjected by his entourage, had simply cracked under the strain? I was still asking myself these questions when, next morning, we left Sringeri for Shravana Belgola. Not until some years later, when the sandalwood country had long ceased to occupy my thoughts, did I learn, quite by accident, that the Shankaracharya was dead. He had drowned while taking his bath, the math authorities said, and the junior Shankaracharya had been installed in his place. The last of the images that rose upon me from the jungles of Mysore was a perfectly nude male figure standing immobile, his arms at his sides, his face expressionless, and his eyes gazing into the far distance, Gomateshwara, Lord of Sacred Mother Cow. As we approached Shravana Balgala, we saw him in the far distance, white against the blue sky, standing at the top of a small hill, the lower part of his body hidden by the surrounding buildings. Less than an hour later, we stood beside the massive feet, looking up past the well-rounded thighs, past the flaccid, wrinkled penis the height of a man, past the broad sweep of the breast and the firm chin, up to the serene face and the eyes, which, oblivious of our presence, continued to gaze out into the endless distance. Who Gomateshwara was and how he came to be standing there, I did not know. According to Jain tradition, he had lived in very ancient, even prehistoric times, being a disciple of one of the legendary predecessors of Mahavira, the founder of Jainism. Leaving his father's kingdom for the forest, he had stood absorbed in meditation for so long that plants had grown round his legs, as though round the trunks of trees. Sure enough, up the side of each enormous leg climbed a tendril, so tall that it rose above our heads, so short that it reached only halfway up to the smoothly jointed knees. With his eyes fixed on infinity, Gomateshwara not only rose out of nature, but transcended her. From the upper galleries of the buildings that surrounded the courtyard in which the giant figure stood, it was possible to see the great oval of its face from waist level, but so majestically calm was its expression, so uncompromisingly distant its gaze, that one felt no nearer than before. Lower down the hill, on either side of the irregular flights of stone-cut steps, stood a number of unpretentious temples, monasteries, and other buildings. In one of them, a learned Jain scholar, a layman, showed us a rich collection of Sanskrit palm-leaf manuscripts. Shravana Balgala was, in fact, one of the most ancient and celebrated centres of Jainism in Mysore, perhaps in the whole of India, and an important place of pilgrimage. According to Jain tradition, it had been founded by Chandragupta Maurya, the grandfather of the Emperor Ashoka, who was said to have ended his days there as a Jain ascetic, committing religious suicide in the most approved manner by starving himself to death. Every 12 years, we were told, the hill was the scene of a great festival, to which tens of thousands of devotees came from all over the country. At the climax of the festival, hundreds of buckets of milk, curds and clarified butter were emptied onto the head of the image from a specially constructed platform and allowed to trickle all the way down to his feet. The giant being a wealthy community, hundreds of thousands of rupees were spent in this way.